Numbers 26. Well, we're going to attempt to cover some ground tonight, but you'll note that we'll be doing a lot of quick review of some of this material, because just like chapters 1 through 10 of Numbers, these chapters from chapter 26 all the way to chapter 32 really mirror the same type of preparation the people have to go into the promised land. Only one big difference. This is 38 years later, and this is a whole new group of people. In fact, you'll find not one of the people, at least in the age bracket of 20 years of age up, are among the group of people that Moses is addressing today. Because every one of them, as God declared, would be laid low in the wilderness because of one thing. The one sin that caused Israel to stumble in the wilderness, and for 38 years there were more funeral services in the wilderness than anything else, and that was unbelief. God spoke, they didn't believe, and so the Lord kind of put them aside, and He found those who would believe Him and trust Him. And you know, it's true today. The biggest struggle you and I face is just trusting the Lord, you know, believing Him. He wants to do what He wants to do. He's got a plan. He's got a purpose. The difficulty you and I have is just, okay, Lord, I'll just calm my soul and quiet myself and trust You no matter what's happening. So chapter 26, it came to pass after the plague. Now, the idea there is after the plague. The last plague we saw was the plague in which the people were being killed because of the joining with Baal Peor of Peor under Balaam's counsel. And it's called the plague because it's the last plague, basically, the last thing that God was using to bring judgment on the old generation. In other words, this was the last, the final group of people that were still left from the old generation now are gone. And it's a whole new generation now. So now they're starting all over. And so they're going to number the people. They're going to go through some last-minute preparations, the same things that they did before with the old generation, but they failed. Now they're doing with the new generation. So you see again in chapter 26, a second census is taken, the second numbering. And I'm not going to belabor all these names and these numbers, but I will tell you that of all the tribes that, you know, went through the wilderness, there were a number of tribes that gained people, a number of tribes that lost people, but overall, the same number of people from 20 years of age, about 600,000, actually 603,500 is what they started with, now they end up with 601,700 people, a whole new 600,000, but they've still got the same number, and it's kind of a zero population growth, so you get the idea that it was a very tough time in the wilderness. To have zero population growth, it is under tough conditions. So I'm not going to labor these names. Simeon, the tribe Simeon, though, you might note, loses a whole lot of people. And it's kind of intimated because of the names that are under Simeon that some of these people were very much susceptible to the sin of with Baal of Peor. So they lost a lot of people in that. And Manasseh and Benjamin both gain quite a few people, so those tribes become stronger. Other than that, we're going to move right on into verse 52 of chapter 26. Now, that was painless. You wouldn't want me to butcher those names anyway. You wouldn't remember them anyway. So the Lord then spoke to Moses, saying, "To these the land shall be divided as an inheritance according to the number of names. To a large tribe you'll give a larger inheritance. To a small tribe you'll give a smaller inheritance. Each shall be given its inheritance according to those who were numbered of them. But the land shall be divided by lot. They'll inherit according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. And according to the lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller." So it's been worked out to kind of draw lots, and yet the larger tribes will be sure to get the larger lots, and the smaller, the smaller. So verse 57 describes, however, through verse 62, that the Levites, or the tribes of the Levites, do not receive an inheritance. You remember, God told them that He was their inheritance, that they were His firstborn, and that He was not giving them an inheritance in this with land, but they were going to represent Him. They would be the priests. They would be those who would serve in the tabernacle and taking care of the tabernacle and the sacrifices. And so the names of the people that the Levites are given here. And verse 63, these are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the children of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. But, notice, among these there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest when they numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. In other words, everyone they numbered in Sinai, there wasn't one of them here. For the Lord had said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness, so there was not left a man of them except Caleb the son of Jephthah and Joshua the son of Nun. Two guys out of the entire lot of them. Incredible. I mean, to think about that. But it should emphasize to us, later in Hebrews you see this picture. Romans, the idea of faith, trusting the Lord. They were laid low because of unbelief. And Joshua and Caleb, who trusted the Lord, who saw the giants, but realized, hey, the Lord is going to take care of them for us. You can't imagine, well, you probably can, the times that you go through difficulties and it's so hard to, okay, Lord, just I'm going to trust you through it and I'm going to praise you through it. There's two things that you can do that are exceedingly helpful when you're encountering a major trial, giants in front of you. Number one is to begin to just worship and praise Him, thanking Him. Just, Lord, You know what's going on. You know what You're doing. I don't understand this, but I'm just going to trust You and praise You through it. And two is just keep going forward. Don't be sidetracked because of the difficulties ahead of you. I've learned this, is that anytime I'm going forward, I am facing 10,000 enemies in front of me. No question about that. But if I turn around, there's 20,000 behind me. So it doesn't matter. Hey, I'll face the 10,000 in front of me. Keep going forward. But it's an expression of faith. The best thing I can do is just continue to praise the Lord and trust Him through it. Now, chapter 27, we come to a very interesting law of inheritance that came up as a result of the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh. The son of Joseph. And these were the names of his daughters. And he gives the names of these five daughters, Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord in the company with Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. In other words, there was no special sin that he had. Like they all died in sin, our father died in sin too. But he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no son? Therefore, give us a possession among the brothers of our father. Now, these gals are special gals, given their names right here in the scripture, and they're not waiting around for men in order to get their inheritance. They're saying, hey, our father had an inheritance. We're single. We don't have any husbands right now to get their inheritance, and we're losing our inheritance. Our father's losing his name, so this isn't right. So you could kind of get the idea here is the first march for women's rights. They're saying, hey, we're not going to take this anymore, you know. We want to know what's going on. I love this because they exhibit a pilgrim character here. They exhibit a strong sense of, hey, we want the inheritance that's ours. And in a way, they're honored here because Moses says, well, wait here. He brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. So a statute has been there providing for women. This really is so incredibly different from every other culture of that day. That the women would have the right for an inheritance was unheard of. You really get the idea that it's not the Bible that has kept women under for so many years as some would have you believe. In reality, the Bible exalts women, that God honors them. And there are different roles in the marriage relationship. The husband is the head of the home, and the wife is submissive unto her husband. But you never see, when the scripture comes to the recognition of women, there is an equality. And later in the New Testament, this is even more exalted. When Peter tells husbands, if you don't grant your wife equal heir, as an equal heir of the grace of life, your prayers will be hindered. And Paul says there's neither male nor female nor Jew nor Greek. You see, they saw into that, that the male-female separation really is just a temporary role in this life. For eternity, there is not going to be a distinction of men over women. That is a very temporary distinction, that our honor and our glory will come as we exalt the Lord, what He has called us to be. Women unto the Lord, men unto the Lord. And there is not a distinction. So I love this. It's a good little picture here. The Lord honoring them and the inheritance. And He says, you'll speak. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers and his father. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the kinsman nearest him in his family. And he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded. So the idea was that the land would go to the family, that they would have the right of that. Now, even though each of these tribes received their lot, one thing you want to be sensitive to: the Lord owns the land. And the people really are leasing it, so to speak, from the Lord. That He owns the land. That you don't own property there in Israel. That you had the right of it to till it from whatever inheritance you had, but it was the Lord's land. Now the Lord said to Moses, go up to this Mount Abarim and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people, which was a euphemism for you'll die. This is it. This is the end of the road for you. As Aaron your brother was gathered, for in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness. You remember that one sin. Moses, faithful in all the Lord's house. But that one area, he failed to properly represent God. And from that one issue, he was not allowed to go into the promised land. He could see it, but he couldn't enjoy it. It's kind of a wild thing. You see how God holds leaders much more accountable. Very accountable for their life, for their direction, especially that they are representing God. James says, be not many teachers, knowing that you will incur a stricter judgment. Those of you who desire an office of bishop or deacon in the church, who desire leadership, it's an honorable ambition. It is a good ambition to say, Lord, I want to be used of you in your church. But know this, it is a requirement that the Lord will hold you greater accountability. He is going to deal more harshly with you in one sense, only because you're an example. So you've got to realize, as a leader, people will see your life in one thing, and then if they see you do one thing, they will justify themselves in the same and even more. So there has to be an example set for a leader, a very strong example. So Moses then spoke to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of all spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. And he'll stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. So this idea of Moses is going to be setting that, or giving the leadership over to Joshua. Joshua is going to take over from there. Now when Moses was commanded to go up in the mountain, Deuteronomy 20:34 actually picks up a little bit of the story. He went up, and the Lord showed him, it says, all of the land of Israel. Now, you really couldn't see physically all the land of Israel from one vantage point. You could see a lot of it. The way it's laid out, if you go up in the mountains of there across the Jordan, you could see a tremendous lot of all the land of Israel. But you couldn't see all of it. Now, the idea here is that even he showed him all the way from the very bottom all the way up to Dan. That was before Dan even took over that northern part. So I get an idea here that Moses actually saw more of the geography, more than just geography, that he saw spiritually into the possession the Lord was going to call them. It said that he was 120 years old and his eyes were not dim, his natural strength was not abated. those meetings with the Lord up on the mountain revived him. And I would imagine it would have been interesting to look at him. Of course, you know, Cecil B. DeMille paints him as very old and decrepit looking. But imagine that, described of him, 120 years old, but his natural strength wasn't abated. He didn't look like that. You might have looked at Moses and thought, wow, he's not that old. He's got a lot of natural strength. His eyes are still clear at 120. Who can tell what type of a life force or system our new body will be on? I mean, the physical body does deteriorate. What would it have been like before the fall? Before the effects on our bodies from the cosmic rays? What would it have been like, you know, because the body does reproduce itself every 7 years. So it would have been a fascinating thought. But I think of this, no vitamins, he climbed mountains at 120 years old, no problem, no huffing and puffing on the way up, and no short of breath, just strong, strong man. And yet now, because of his disobedience, he's letting it go, turning the leadership over to Joshua. And Joshua is one who is, it's said of him, he was, in him is the Spirit. Here is a man who walked by faith also. He knew his God. He'd learned from Moses, too, a number of things. He'd walked with Moses all this time. And now he is going to take the children of Israel into the wilderness. And we're going to see some incredible things with Joshua, who was also up in years, and yet a spiritual man, especially important because going into the promised land, they have to walk by faith. Every step of the way, you're going to see Joshua's faith tested. You're going to see him struggle. You're going to see him have incredible victory as he learns more and more to walk by faith and not by sight. So Moses has chosen the successor as the Lord has directed him. And he will have with him Eleazar the priest, who will inquire before the Lord with the judgment of the Urim. In other words, how the Lord guided them with the Urim and the Thummim, we don't know exactly. But the Lord did use these. Perhaps it was a couple of stones that some traditions have that, you know, they got yes or no answers from picking out various stones, drawing lots. We're not exactly sure, but the priest is going to be representing the Lord's direction to Joshua. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua, sent him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and he laid hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. Now, Moses is still in charge. He's inaugurated him to take leadership. He hasn't gone up to the mountain yet. We're still going to see the record now because we don't pick up the narrative right now because there is, again, this picture of reiterating before the people the various offerings. Chapter 28 is a total repetition of the offerings that we've already looked at quite plainly in Leviticus and also in Numbers. So we're not going to belabor them. We see the various offerings that were to be lifted up. So moving right on through, we come to verse 26, verse 16. We pick up to where they're reiterating the feasts that are there for Israel. So they have the various offerings, whether they're the daily, the weekly, the monthly offerings. We come to the Feast of Passover on the 14th day of the first month, which was the Passover of the Lord, celebrating their deliverance from Egypt, their redemption out of the land of Egypt. And then the 15th day of the month, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was associated with Passover. Verse 26, in the first day of the first fruits, when you bring new grain offering to the Lord at your Feast of Weeks, you shall have a holy convocation, do no customary work. So this First Fruits, which was also really the Feast of Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, as it's called. And that was 50 days after the Passover. And then in the seventh month, verse chapter 29. Now, the seventh month was a very important month. You get this idea that sevens, everything's set out in sevens. 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months, 7 years, the sabbatical year, in what I feel, again, you have a very good case for the 7,000th year, perhaps being the year in which the Lord comes back and sets up His kingdom on the world. Now, what year that is, we could only speculate. I feel we're close, because if you've got 4,000 years before Christ and close to 2,000 years after Christ, you're getting to the 6,000, you know, through the 6,000 years of human history, somewhere around here. I think on the 7,000th year, the Lord is going to redeem the world, that He is going to bring the world rest on the 7,000th year. And just as one day with the Lord is 1,000 years is as one day, the world has its 6 days of toil under human, you know, kind, and then we're going to have the seventh day. It'll be set free. It'll rest from its labors. So it's a very good case. I like that. I think the Lord does deal in sevens. I think it's very wrong of us, however, to start saying, okay, now, the year 2000 is the exact year that we find the 7,000th year. We don't know that. We don't know exactly how it was reckoned, but I can tell you this. The Bible does say you know the signs of the times. We don't even need that one thing in particular to tell us. We are very close to the end. Everything else is coming into place. When we get into the book of Revelation, we'll be looking at the revelation of Jesus Christ. We'll try to avoid a lot of the little hobby horses that people get off on, the little prophetic fads that are there. But we'll see actual facts of what the Scripture says, and we'll just look around us and say, hey, we are very close. We do know that. No one knows of the day or the hour, but we certainly know we are very close to the end. So the seventh month and the seventh day of the first day of the month, you'll have a holy convocation. Do no customary work, for it is a day of blowing trumpets. They would have blown the shofar. It would have been it turned into the New Year celebration, because the seventh month became, from the legal standpoint, the first month. So Passover was in the fourth month, which was considered the first month. And if you're confused with that, don't be surprised, because it gets a little wild. You know, you're celebrating the New Year's celebration over there in October, and yet you know that Passover was in the first month, but that's the religious calendar. So it gets a little difficult to figure out what month you're in when you're in Israel. But anyway, Feast of Trumpets, then also on the 10th day, verse 7 of the 7th month. Again, I'm going through this real quick because this is reiteration of what he's already described. You have the feast, or the Day of Atonement, the day that they would afflict their souls, the only day that they were really required to afflict their soul and humble and fast and pray, not do any work. The various offerings that are presented here describing this particular day. This day in particular was very interesting and unique in that the high priest was the one that did all the sacrifices. So it was an incredible busy day for him, and I think it would have been a great picture for the people of Israel as they stood apart and just humbled themselves, fasting, watching toward the tabernacle, the high priest do all the work, knowing that that one person was standing in their place when he would go into the holiest of holies, representing the entire nation. And what a great picture to know that one day there would be coming a true high priest who would go into the true holiest of holies with his own blood and lift himself up as a sacrifice, and once and for all would settle the sin issue. So just again, the preparation of the people's minds for the coming deliverer. On the 15th day, verse 12 of the 7th month, another holy convocation, no customary work. You shall keep a feast of the Lord 7 days. So the seventh month was pretty busy. On the first day, you had the Feast of Trumpets. Then the 10th day, Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, fast day. And then on the 15th day, another 7 day feast. So during the time of harvest, they kind of celebrated. We celebrate Thanksgiving one day, bang, we're gone, back into the work. Imagine 7 days feasting. What a great time that must have been. All right, you know, and I, you know, people look at God and they sometimes look at the laws and the people had it so rough. Hey, they were feasting all the time. A whole lot more vacation than you and I get. And having a great time feasting, you get an idea the Lord wants to feast with His people. He wants them to enjoy life and enjoy Him. And certainly that would have been a picture here. So the various offerings that are detailed here, the reason they're such a repetitive nature, if you read through this, you'd be like, okay. It's kind of reads like a poem, is that this would have been kind of a ceremony in a way, that this would have been carried through in a particular way, kind of the rhyme and the meter here, only because it's a ceremonial thing, a very solemn type of an occasion, as the various sacrifices and all the different animals that they would have been offering up on this particular feast. Of course, there was a lot of people to feed. And when the animals were sacrificed, the Lord got His part, the fat, and the people got the rest of the animal. So they had their feast. So the Lord was eating the fat, the best, and the people got theirs. And They were feasting together. Now we come to chapter 30. And we come to the regulation of vows. You might even have that as a little subscript in your study Bibles. The Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. If a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow, and her father holds his peace, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father overrules her on the day that he hears, then none of her vows and her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father overruled her." So the idea of a vow that you would make, a special consecration vow to the Lord. I vow, Lord, if you do this for me, you know, I'll give this or I'll do that. And say a young gal in the home, you know, she gets excited and she says, "Lord, if you do this for me, then I'll remain a virgin the rest of my life, you know, perhaps, or I'll do this, you know, thing." And if her father hears it and he goes, "No, you know, I know that that's not going to be realistic for her," he has the right to overrule her. But the idea here, the laws of vows, Jesus later said that you shouldn't vow, you shouldn't swear. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I'm amazed at how much in religion today rests upon the promises of people to God. And that's not what God intended. And yet people get themselves into a quandary with their promises to God. You know, and I remember, I'm sure, in a few tight spots. In fact, I remember one time I was lost in the woods in Michigan. And I was walking with my dog Gretchen, and we were out there in the woods, and it was getting dark, and we were lost. And I remember getting quite afraid as it started to get dark, because I had no idea. We were miles from anywhere, and I thought, we're lost. And I was hoping my dog, you know, "Hey, man's best friend, come on, Gretchen, what's wrong with you?" She was just following me. And so I remember sitting down and thinking, "Lord, God," you know, of course, at that time I was totally backslidden. And yet I knew enough to pray, and I said, "God, if you get me out of this, you know, I'll follow you." And I remember, you know, it was the funniest thing. I get up from this stump that I was sitting on for a moment, and I just started walking in a particular direction. Took a few right turns and some trails, and there I was. In the open, there was our campsite. And I was like, "All right." But by the end of that night, I was already totally flown away. You know, I was going my own direction. And yet it's true, a lot of people, they put a lot of weight on a promise that they make to God. "God, if you do this for me, then I'll do this." Well, the Lord knows our nature. He allowed a certain balance of vows to be made, but really, vows were very easily broken. Because we don't have the power to follow through. We can't, and Jesus basically said that you don't have the power to change one hair white or black. How can you, with your words, say what will be? That's the bottom line. We don't have the power for that. My intentions may be there. I might say, "Lord God, I will promise I will do this or that." But who am I to even say that? How do I know I'll even have the power to follow through with that? True Christianity is not rest upon your promise to God. "I promise, God, I'll be a good Christian. I'll follow you. You know, just do this for me." It's not resting upon that. It's resting upon His promise to you. He has made a covenant with you. He says, "I will perform that which concerns you. I will do that in your life. You can't do it. Your promises of great love and devotion," he told one of his people, you know, Ephraim, he said, "Your devotion is like the morning dew. It goes away early." You know, the dew comes out in the morning and it's there and everything's wet. And you go out and that's their devotion. But by the time the sun comes up, it's already gone. And that's a picture of many people's devotion to God. When things are going in that direction, they'll go in that direction with the Lord. But as soon as they have an opportunity to go in another direction, well, it's very difficult to keep their vows. So what amazes me, too, that if our yes is to be yes and our no, no, it amazes to me that so much in Christian television is based upon some big begathon where people are being asked to make pledges and vows. I have difficulty with pledges and faith pledges, they call them, or vows, because, again, it just comes back down to that thing. You know, I'm making a promise that I'm going to give you, God, this much money. And what is that? That's based upon my power, my ability to do it? I think that's ridiculous. I think it's a very bad trap to fall into. But these guys apparently make a lot of money off of that, you know, getting the pledges. And once you're in the motion of the moment, oh, yes, God, if you answer this prayer, I'll give you $1,000, you know. And of course, now you're bound by your word, and they've got you. You know, they're going to send you the letters and remind you of your promise, and you get to pay up or you get bugged from them forever. Well, vows. So the Lord even gave within the law an out for people who would have not been accountable fully, a young woman in her father's home. Verse 6, it says, if indeed she takes a husband while bound by her vows or by a rash utterance from her lips by which she bound herself, and her husband hears it and makes no response to her on the day he hears it, then her vows shall stand and her agreements by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband overrules her on the day he hears it, he shall make her void. He shall make void her vow, which she vowed and what she uttered with her lips, by which she bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. But any vow of a widow or a divorced woman by herself, she shall stand against her. And if she's vowed in her husband's house, or bound herself by an agreement with an oath, and her husband heard it, and he made no response to her, and did not overrule her, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband truly made them void on the day she heard them, then whatever proceeded from her lips concerning her vows or concerning the agreement binding her, it shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and the Lord will forgive her. Every vow and every binding oath to afflict her soul, her husband may confirm it or her husband may void it. But if her husband makes no response, whatever, the repetition there, that she is not guilty of it, or she would not bear the guilt, but if he makes them void. Now, verse 16 says, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses between man and his wife, and between a father and his daughter in her youth and in her father's house. Now we come to chapter 31. Now chapter 31 is a very fascinating chapter. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take vengeance for the children of Israel on the Midianites. And afterward you shall be gathered to your people. So now this final battle that Moses is instructed to take upon the Midianites, and then he's going to be taken home. It's a very interesting battle. It's a day of vengeance. There is a time for vengeance. The Midianites were those who tried to stumble the people of Israel. Now, Moses was very familiar with these people, having traveled in the area of Midian, having married a Midianite woman. And yet, God oversaw his condition, his situation, but the people of Midian had basically turned against Israel completely. They were counseled by Balaam to put a stumbling block in front of the people. So Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm some of yourselves for the war, and let them go against the Midianites to take vengeance for the Lord on Midian. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war. So they were recruited from the divisions of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Now, out of an army of 600,000 men, 12,000 was really nothing. I mean, these people who bothered them, who put such stumbling blocks in front of them, obviously they had to resort to other tactics because they had no power militarily against them. If you can imagine only 12,000 being sent out. It could also be that the Lord is just picking a small number to show them that he is going to fight their battles, that they don't need to depend upon their own strength. And so it could be that way. So it says that Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 from each tribe. He sent them to the war with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, with the holy articles and the signal trumpets in his hands. So now, this is a very unusual battle, too, because the priest is going in the front. You'll find this in some of the battles, the wars of the Lord, so to speak, as he leads his people. It's very strange when he puts the choir members in front. The idea is that it's a spiritual battle. The Lord is going to give them victory. You know, we often will look at things we face and we try to figure out, how are we going to overcome this obstacle? Maybe it's a problem in our health. And the doctors are saying, well, this is what you've got to do, and this is your only option, this or this, and that's all you can do. Well, that might be the only option from God, from man's standpoint, but God is God. Maybe you're faced with bills that you're looking at your income, you're looking at your output, and you're thinking, well, I don't know what's going to happen. But you pray, Lord, you know what's going on here, and you commit it to him. He is able to overcome the natural picture because he wants the glory. He wants to show his power on your behalf. And here is a picture of the spiritual battle. Now, They warred against the Midianites, just as the Lord commanded Moses, and they killed all the males. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of those who were killed, namely Evi, Rechem, Zur, Reba, the five kings of Midian, Balaam, the son of Beor. They also killed with a sword. So we read about him and we saw his end as the scripture declared. Remember, he sounded really noble in all of his prophecies, but he had his eye on that money that he could have had from the king of Moab. And now he finds himself fighting with the Midianites and on their behalf, working together with the Moabites. The whole picture here, you find Balaam's end. He wanted to die the death of the righteous, but his end was the death of the wicked. So the children of Israel took all the women of Midian captive with their little ones, took a spoil all their cattle, all their flocks, all their goods. They burned with fire all the cities where they dwelt and all their forts, and they took all the spoil, all the booty, both of man and beast. And they brought the captives, the booty, and the spoil to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the children of Israel, to the camp on the plains of Moab by the Jordan, across from Jericho. And Moses, Eleazar the priest, and all the leaders of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. But Moses was angry with the officers of his army, with the captains over thousands, captains over hundreds, who had come from the battle. And Moses said to them, "Have you kept all the women alive? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately." So every male will be killed, even the little boys, and every woman who has known a man intimately. "But keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately." And so they took the spoil. Now again, in our Western civilization, this sounds very cruel, hard-hearted, difficult to understand. My answer to that is, if we knew all the factors involved, we probably wouldn't say that. We don't know. I can't try to come up with some westernized reason why God did this. I can't answer for God. I don't know the whys of God. And I think it's kind of foolish to try to come up with some sophisticated, well, you know, now the people who have these particular diseases and da-da-da-da-da. I don't know. I really don't know. And I don't think there's any way to know. Some of these things face us as just areas where God knows, and He knows the reasons why He did it. And who am I to question God? Who am I to answer to God and say, "God, now why did you do that?" He doesn't have to answer us. He's told us everything He wants us to know. So He wants us to trust Him the rest of the way. But it does seem cruel, and yet His reasons are His reasons. Now, it says, "As for you, remain outside the camp 7 days. Whoever has killed any person," again, if they touch the dead bodies, they would be unclean. "Whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves and your captives on the third day and on the seventh day. Purify every garment, everything made of leather, everything woven of goat's hair, and everything made of wood." Then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to the battle, "This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord commanded Moses. Only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can endure fire, you shall put through the fire, and it shall be clean, and it shall be purified with the water of purification. But all that cannot endure fire, you shall put through water, and you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day, be clean, and afterwards you may come into the camp." And then the Lord said to Moses, saying, "Count up the plunder that was taken, both of man and beast, you and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts, between those who took part in the war, who went out to battle, and all the congregation. And levy a tribute for the Lord on the men of war who went to battle, one of every 500 of the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as a heave offering to the Lord. And from the children of Israel's half you shall take one of every 50 drawn from the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep from all the livestock, and give them to the Levites to keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord." So they're divvying out all the details. Now, it's fascinating how much spoil they took. I'm not going to belabor going through all the record of the booty as verse 32 all the way through the end of this chapter describes. But one thing you notice, that when it comes right down to it, if you calculate the number of people in Israel and the amount that they got here in this particular battle, incredible lot of spoil. It amounts to, for every soldier, 28 sheep, 3 cattle, 2 donkeys, and 1.5 persons. I don't know if they divided the persons in half, but how they worked that one out. not to mention all the gold and the silver. So that's an incredible lot. I mean, that's quite a valuable undertaking when you add up everything that they received. Now, notice verse 49 for a moment. They said to Moses, "Your servants have taken account of the men of war who are under our command, and not a man of us is missing." That should strike you as very, very odd. I mean, even in the Gulf War, with our superior technology and everything, we still had casualties. Very little in comparison to the other side, but still casualties. For a number of people to go out with swords and spears and fight a battle and not one of them die should have spoken to Israel very strongly that I am fighting for you. The Lord is with them. This is a miraculous battle. It is a battle over the enemies of the Lord. It's a victory so dramatic that even those who had a real difficult time believing in the Lord would be able to say, "Wow, Lord, you're with us." You know, this kind of brings my mind and attention to where Israel's at today. If you look at the history of the war in 1967, 73, and 82, these victories were also so incredibly dramatic. Some of the records of them that were just so unbelievable, and that God protected His people. In some of the wars, their enemies were so close to total victory that they didn't even know it, and yet just a few people were the turning point of the entire battle. On the Golan Heights, there's a record of one lone man in a tank. Everyone else had been wiped out, and he had one tank. And so he'd come up on a hill, he'd fire, he'd go back down, he'd go around the other direction, all the while he was signaling onto his radio to pretend people. Like he was signaling, "Why don't you go up here, go up there?" And he was like talking to all these fictitious tanks that didn't exist. They were picking up his records, and they were afraid a whole group, a battalion was over there, a whole line of legion of tanks, so they didn't advance any. And he kept the entire Syrian army at bay, one tank, until he got reinforcements from the Air Force, and eventually they were to drive the people. Had the Syrians known there was just one guy over there, one tank, they would have totally taken over the entire Golan Heights, all the way down, come right in down to Israel, and there would have been no stopping them. But this one man held them off. And in battles like that, stories like that, just abounded throughout all that happened with Israel. The bottom line is this: God had promised He'd bring His people back into the land, and He would protect them. Now, you don't have to get political on it. It's simple. God said He'd bring them back. He did. He's making a promise to people, to a nation, to a group of people. I think we as Americans, as Christians, have to recognize God is going to be true to His word. And if ever we don't stand behind the Jewish nation, if ever we say, "Well, Israel, you know, forget about them. Hey, blessed are those who bless His people. Cursed are those who curse them." I really believe that applies to the nation Israel. No, yes, they're not spiritual at this point. But one day, God is going to be faithful to them, and they will awaken unto the fact and the reality of their Messiah. And tremendous sufferings they will go through in the meantime. But you cannot deny the Lord's incredible protection over them. Miraculous battles, in the same way in Israel's past, the Lord protecting them, so that even the most atheistic Jew would have to say that God was with them. They would know it. Chapter 32. The children of Reuben. And we looked at this story in this morning session. The children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of livestock. When they saw the land of Jazer, the land of Gilead, that indeed the region was a place for livestock, the children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spoke to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, to the leaders of the congregation, saying, "Ataroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Eliashibim, Nebo, and Beon, the country which the Lord defeated before the congregation of Israel, is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. Therefore," they said, "if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession, and do not take us over the Jordan." Moses said to the children of Gad and to the children of Reuben, "Shall your brethren go to war while you sit here?" In other words, don't you think that's a little selfish? Now why will you discourage the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord has given them? In other words, you're not only is it selfish, but you will discourage them. And now he gives them a history lesson. They should know this. Thus your fathers did when I sent them away from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land. They discouraged the heart of the children of Israel, so they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger was aroused on that day, and he swore an oath, saying, surely none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and above shall see the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me. Except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. So the Lord's anger was aroused against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until all generation had done evil in the sight of the Lord was gone. And look, you have risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will once again leave them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all these people. And they came near to him and said, we'll build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones, but we ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the children of Israel until we have brought them into their place, and our little ones will dwell in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We'll not return to our homes until every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance. So they agree to that. They say, we won't go back to our homes until everyone's inherited their inheritance, for we will not inherit with them on the other side of the Jordan beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on this eastern side of the Jordan. A tragic thing, though, that even though they're holding to their covenant, and they do go in and fight, they are the first ones to be attacked, and any time Israel is attacked, and usually they're the ones that suffer the greatest. They're living on the outskirts of the Promised Land. They're basically picking a comfortable place, a place that, from the standpoint of the carnal mind, looks like the best place they could be. From their standpoint, you know, they esteem the promises of God about the Promised Land to be not that important. They think they know what's best. How many times I have done the same thing? I have figured out what I thought was best, and I strove to get that will accomplished. I said, God, no, if you only do this. Now that I look back in my life, I look back at some of the things, some of the decisions that I was very headstrong about. I look back at, you know, some of the things I wanted to do, I wanted to see the Lord do in my life. I think of one particular girl that I thought for sure she's the best choice for me. And I look back and I look at all those prayers that I prayed. I begged the Lord, answer. How glad I am that he didn't answer. How glad I am that he closed doors. How glad I am that he did his will and not my will. Yeah, because I thought I knew what was best. And certainly, the Gadites and the Reubenites look from the carnal mind. It looks, hey, this is good pasture. We've got cattle. Put the two together. Hey, what more is there to think about? It's very obvious to us. Later in Joshua, we're going to see some other things that Joshua was presented with. That you would think, oh, he doesn't have to think about this. Very obvious. Decision's right there, right in front of him. Go ahead and make it. But he doesn't know all the facts. You and I do not know all the facts about our life. We look at a job and we think, oh, if I could only get that job, that'll be it. Perfect. Everything I need. Or a house, or a place to live, or a person to marry. Oh, that's the perfect one. And in our mind, it looks good. And the Lord closes the door. And we fight, and we struggle, and we strive, and we get angry with God. And all the more he's trying to drag us into a much better place, a much better situation. He knows what's perfect for us. And we're fighting him all the way because we have our mind on this side of the Jordan. This is what we want. Well, Moses said to them, if you go, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before the Lord for the war, and all your armed men cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies from before them, before him, the land is subdued before the Lord, and afterward you may return and be blameless before the Lord and before Israel, and this land shall be your possession before the Lord. Go ahead, you can have it. But if you do not do so, take note, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Build cities for your little ones and folds for your sheep, and do what is proceeded out of your mouth. And the children of Gad and the children of Reuben spoke to Moses, saying, Your servants will do as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our flocks, and all our livestock will be here in the cities of Gilead, but your servants will cross over, every man armed for war, before the Lord to battle, just as my Lord says. Now, they have been in the sight of Jericho for some time. It could be that the sight of Jericho is making a few of the people of Israel skittish, you know, looking at these heavily fortified cities across the Jordan River, just in their view. I mean, they can look right over the Jordan from where they are and see all this happening and think, we're going to fight against those guys, huh? Okay. And I could imagine that it probably would have been discouraging to think of that. And every area of this battle before, the Lord's trying to teach them, I'm going to fight for you. Not one of them is missing. Reuben and Gad now looking at the carnal aspect, they're going to, okay, we'll do it our way. The Lord says, fine, but if you don't go, you've sinned, and your sin will find you out. Certainly it's true of every person's sin. It will be found out in due time. Even in this life, whether through your conscience, whether through your weakened condition, whether through a number of things your sin is found out, it will be found out. But ultimately, certainly, it will be found out because everything will be laid open and bare before the Lord. He sees the motives of our heart. He judges the intents of our heart. He knows us. So verse 28, Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest, to Joshua the son of Nun, and the chief fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel. Moses said to them, If the children of Gad and the children of Reuben cross over the Jordan with you, every man armed for battle before the Lord, and the land is subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead as a possession. But if they do not cross over armed with you, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. In other words, they're going to have to take their possession on the other side of the Jordan just like everybody else. Then the children of Gad and the children of Reuben answered, saying, As the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do, and we will cross over armed before the Lord into the land of Canaan, but the possessions of our inheritance shall remain with us on this side of the Jordan. So Moses gave to the children of Gad, to the children of Reuben, half the tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, and the land with its cities and the borders and cities of the surrounding country. And the children of Gad then built these various cities that I'm not going to mention. They built more cities that I'm not going to mention, and built more cities that I'm not going to mention. So they get their inheritance. We covered a lot of territory. When we go, and we will finish up Numbers next week, and we'll get right into Deuteronomy, we're going to get into some fascinating portions as the Lord reviews His covenant with Israel. And we'll move through and eventually get into Joshua, some fascinating battles. And before we know it, we're going to be in the midst of Israel in the land, in their possession. Potential that's incredible as God wants to raise His people up, but there's a digression because of their own carnal nature. You and I, the thing that keeps us so often from the promise of God is it's not the difficulty that we face. It's our attitude toward the difficulty. It's our viewing the problem. That's the problem. It's our viewpoint. It's our opinion. It's our looking at the situation. I don't care what it is, but oftentimes if you think of how you're struggling with a particular area, it's not because of the problem itself, because we all face that. We all are in this life facing struggles and trials. Things don't go the way we'd like them. The real difficulty is how we look at it, and I'll tell you how we need to continue to look at it. The thing that is embedded in the children of Israel's mind is that they struggle when they have unbelief. But when they trust the Lord and they go forward, they tighten their belt and they believe the Lord opens a way before them which didn't appear before. And it's so true. Who could tell what the Lord wanted to do when Karen and I came out to New Jersey? I had no idea. I didn't have this great ambition. Didn't have this great plan. Oh, now we're going to do this and such, and I've got it all worked out. We came out, and as far as I knew, if the Lord wanted us to teach a Bible study with five or six people, that was fine. Whatever He wanted to do. And I didn't know what way the Lord was going to open. We only knew one other couple when we came out here, and really, it was wild. How did I arrive at that position? Well, it was kind of just a strange discontent where I was at. Couldn't understand it, couldn't figure it out, but I knew God had something for us. And I felt like the four lepers at the gate who were starving because of the famine, and they said, well, we can't go back in the city, they're dying there. Let's go into the camp of the enemy, and who can tell? Maybe they'll kill us. Maybe we'll live, but either way, we're going to die. So I kind of thought, well, let's go to the Garden State and see what happens. If we die, we die, you know? And I can't tell you how blessed I am to see what the Lord has done. I feel like a spectator. He just keeps opening more and more ways, and God just opens more doors, and it's really exciting. And I want to encourage you. There were times, I mean, I had my arguments with God, plenty of them, where I didn't like the way He was dealing in my life. I thought I could do better. And we all have those times, but just to continue to trust Him no matter what. And you learn, and you go on, and you say, okay, Lord, I'll let You do it Your way. I tried my way before. But as we began just to trust Him, the Lord began to open doors, and He wants to do some incredible things. He just wants us to get out of His way and stop murmuring and complaining and believe Him. Who can tell? The Lord knows.